From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Our regular political commentator, New York Times columnist David Brooks, has written what he calls the happiest story you've ever read. It's a book about the insights of contemporary neuroscience, psychology, sociology, philosophy, and it's all wrapped into the fictional lives of Harold and Erica, husband and wife, successful professionals. We start with the early lives of Harold's parents, and we end with Harold's death of natural causes on a porch in Aspen, Colorado. Along the way, the social scientists and neurobiologists appear and reappear like a Greek chorus explaining to us that what Harold and Erica do is hardly random. Their nature is our nature, and we are far more predictable beings than we might think. The book is called The Social Animal, and David Brooks, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you. Great to be with you.
What led you to abandon or at least dilute your day job as a Burkean conservative monitor of political Washington for peering inside our brains?
Failure. I covered a bunch of policy failure. So and when the Soviet Union fell, we sent all these economists into Russia when what they really lacked was social trust. We invaded Iraq totally oblivious to the psychological trauma and the cultural realities of Iraq. We had financial regulatory policies based on the idea that bankers were sort of rational creatures who would make smart decisions. And I've covered education for 20 years, and we've reorganized all the boxes to very little effect. And the reality of education is that people learn from people they love. But if you mention the word love at a congressional hearing, they look at you like you're Oprah. And so all these policy failures were more or less based on a false view of human nature, that we're cold, rationalistic individuals who respond to incentives. And so while all these failures based on this bad view of human nature were over on one side of my life, all these scientists, philosophers, and others were developing a more accurate view of human nature, which is that emotion is more important than reason, that we're not individuals, we're deeply interconnected, and most importantly, that most of our thinking happens below the level of awareness.
So to give an example of how the book reads, we follow Erica, who's the daughter of an absentee Mexican immigrant, a father, and a bipolar Chinese immigrant, a mother. And when she's a kid, she enters charter school. We read that, and in short order, we're reading about ant colonies and emergent systems.
Yes, well, you know, I wanted to tell it as a story, in part because I wanted to illustrate the science in real world, and most importantly, because I wanted the way the story is told to match the subject matter.
Without giving away the entire story here, Erica succeeds and comes to Washington, and her husband, Harold, follows her. And he discovers things about what people in Washington, this city that you and I both work in, what people value, what you can talk about, what you can't talk about.
Yeah, well, this is the most emotionally avoidant city on Earth, as we know. And as I mentioned, you know, you can't talk about love. You can't talk about things that are unconscious. We have economists really serving as the gateway between human nature and the way we do policymaking and CBO reports. And economists have human nature like half right, but half wrong. And so some of the things that really influence how we do are these forces below consciousness driven by emotion. And some of them are sort of trivial that I admire. One bit of research shows that people named Dennis are disproportionately likely to become dentists. People named Lawrence become lawyers because we unconsciously gravitate toward the familiar. And I've named my daughter President of the United States Brooks for that reason. So those are some of the subtle unconscious things. But more powerfully, our moral intuitions are not based on reason. They're based on our feelings about empathy and fairness. So human nature is really based on these social connections, seeing relationships. And in Washington, we see individuals. We do not see relationships.
And in a larger sense, you write that the way we are taught to think about things is to break them down, is to dissect them, rather than to think of phenomena more broadly and more connected.
Yeah, so let's go back to education, the thing I care most about. We've spent all this time with big schools, small schools, but what really matters is how good people are at relating to one another. So scientists can take an 18-month-old kid and look at how the kid relates to mom, and they can predict with 77% accuracy if the kid's going to graduate from high school. And the question is, are you able to relate? Some kids have communication, so when they get to school, they know how to communicate with teachers. About 20% of kids are what they call avoidantly attached. And so when they come into the classroom, it's like a sailboat tacking into the wind. They want to get close to teachers, but they're going at diagonals because they don't know how to do it. And those kids, even at age 30, will have two-thirds fewer friends because they do not know how to relate to people. And it's tough to talk about that in a world of CBO reports, but that actually is the most important thing when you're talking about how we raise our kids, how we conduct business, and everything else.
But it's also a little threatening to talk about these things, which to talk about the early signs that are determinant of children's future, because we think in terms of profiling and tracking and figuring out, inferring too much about six-year-olds, about what lies in store for them and what kind of training we should provide.
That's absolutely right. There's nobody whose life course is determined at 18 months or 6 years old. Things happen later. You can have a mentor. You can have a strong relationship. But they open up pathways. And those pathways are always changing. But the key point is not to think of people as these rational creatures responding to incentives. Think of the models in their heads. Think of the way they see the world. Think of how they emotionally react to a situation. Some people perceive fear. Some people don't. And I'm a middle-aged white guy. I'm not exactly comfortable talking about emotion. I told my wife that me writing about emotion is like Gandhi writing about gluttony. It's not like the natural thing I do. But that's where the evidence lies.
Do so many findings about what we are, which would show that we're wired for much of what we become. Our very early experiences determine where we'll be. For you, does it reinforce a conservative skepticism about schemes that assume our perfectibility or at least our potential for great improvement?
Well, we're a lot more complicated than we think, and we should be modest. One of the things it teaches us, there's a lot more going on than we understand, and we should be really curious or cautious about overconfidence. So 94% of college professors think they're above average teachers. 96% of high school students think they're above average leadership skills. And so we should be aware that there are things going deep down inside. And so you should be cautious. It doesn't lead to classic conservatism, though. It leads to an awareness of community, I think.
So since you've been writing about politics and Washington all the time, has this involvement in social science and psychological and neuroscience research, has it significantly altered the way you see the politics of, say, an election year?
Yeah, absolutely. Because you learn to see, first of all, emotional connections. You learn to see relationships first. So, for example, the Middle East is blowing up one nation after another. You learn to see the power, how those signals transfer from person to person, how moods can swing across a country. And it's made me much more suspicious, actually, of the free market. Because we have to have, the free market produces a lot of wealth, but it's embedded. It's embedded in a series of understandings. And if you don't have those relationships, then people can't thrive in that free market. Do they have an ability to control their impulses? Do they have an ability to work in groups? Groups are much smarter than individuals. And the groups that do well, it's not shaped by how smart the people are in the group. It's shaped by how well they signal each other. Do they take turns when they're having a conversation? And so even when you see something like the free market, you don't see like Ayn Rand, rational individuals. You see groups and competing groups and collaborating groups deeply intertwined with one another.
David Brooks, thank you very much for talking with us.
Great to be with you.
David's new book is called The Social Animal, A Story of Love, Character, and Achievement.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Six of the top 10 most successful films last year were in 3D. Movies like Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland.
A land full of wonder, mystery.
Here's the trick. Alice in Wonderland, as with many 3D movies these days, wasn't actually shot in 3D. It was converted to 3D after everything was shot. Lucasfilm recently announced that it would be doing the same thing with all six Star Wars films. With 3D looking like it's here to stay, so too are the companies that specialize in this kind of after-the-fact 3D makeover. NPR's Shireen Marisol Meraji visited one that is so busy it can't hire fast enough.
Legend 3D in San Diego, California, is responsible for many of the 3D sequences in Alice in Wonderland. Although Legend 3D didn't get started on Alice until 2009, founder and neuroscientist Barry Sandrew knew conversion was the future way back in 2005.
What happened is I saw a prototype of the Samsung 3D television. That coupled with an understanding of what Jim Cameron was doing with Avatar, we knew that this was going to be a game changer.
He was right. Today, Legend 3D is in the process of converting six feature films, but he won't say which ones for legal reasons. In 2005, Sandrew had 25 employees. Today, there are more than 400 in San Diego, another 800 in India.
One, two, three.
That's a gaggle of Legend 3D folks saying hello to NPR. It's normally pretty quiet here. Young men in their early 20s, with some women in the mix, work side by side in large, dark rooms, hunched in front of their computer screens. Employees on this floor are going through movie scenes one frame at a time, identifying parts of shots that need added depth. The work looks very precise and tedious, but it's good work in a tough economy, and Sandro is hiring about 20 people a month.
We're hiring people straight out of art school, and we're giving people an opportunity that they would never have if they were working up in L.A. in the Hollywood studios. I mean, they're working on first-run feature films that most people would dream about doing.
When did you graduate?
2000 and, I don't know, does it say my diploma?
The very first stereo artist at Legend 3D can't remember what year he graduated from college. Good thing his diploma's hanging on the wall.
Brooks Institute, Cyrus J. Gladstone?
Yes.
Bachelor of Arts?
June of 2008.
So 3 years later, you've got a corner office.
Yep.
Cyrus J. Gladstone is 23 years old. He won't tell me exactly how much he makes, but he says he's comfortable. Gladstone isn't worried that his meteoric rise to success won't stick. He thinks 3D has reached the tipping point, and so does his colleague, Tony Pace Carstensen, a senior visual effects producer.
That's how I see movies now. It seems normal to see things in 3D stereo on the big screen.
Carstensen got her start in radio and has seen the media landscape change over her long career. She calls 2D films flatties now and is already imagining the possibilities beyond 3D.
We're on our way to the holodeck. I feel like, you know, there'll be a point in time where you go to the theater and you'll walk in, it will surround you. It won't just be on the screen. You'll be on Pandora.
That's the magical land in James Cameron's Avatar. The holodeck may be a long way off, but until then, there are plenty of 2D favorites adding a third dimension. Next year, you might be able to reach out and high-five a young Leo DiCaprio as he yells,
"I'm the king of the world!"
on the bow of the Titanic. And if you're fresh out of art school and tech savvy, this 3D conversion world is yours to rule. Shireen Marisol Meraji, NPR News.
And on a happier note, it is Mardi Gras, Fat Tuesday. It's called that because today is traditionally celebrated as the last day of indulgence and revelry before Christians observe the annual fasting season before Easter, known as Lent. But if you've ever celebrated Mardi Gras in New Orleans, home of the nation's biggest carnival parade, then you'd know that no celebration is complete without a king cake. The traditional king cake looks like a coffee cake. It's round or oval shaped. It's often braided and it's served with a surprise inside. Joining us now to share a little bit more about the tradition of the king cake is pastry chef Jean-Luc Albin. He is the proprietor of Maurice French Pastries in Metairie, Louisiana, right outside New Orleans. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, and happy Mardi Gras.
Happy Mardi Gras to you. Now, I understand that you make thousands of king cakes every carnival season. Do you know what the history is of the king cake?
Well, basically, it is the original king cake from New Orleans started here in 1872 when it was a celebration to the Mardi Gras Ball and the Mardi Gras parade and all the parties going on from l'Epiphanie, which is on January the 6th, the beginning of king cake season.
And there's a surprise inside. Do you mind telling us what the surprise is?
Well, the surprise one time used to be a bean. Now we'll put a plastic baby, and the plastic baby represent baby Jesus.
And if you get the piece that happens to have the little baby Jesus in it, does something special happen?
Well, you become the king for that party, and you must get a king cake and host the next party in order to get another king.
Oh, okay.
And it goes on until Mardi Gras Day.
Okay. Now, I know you don't want to tell me all of your secrets, but is it hard to prepare a really good king cake, or is it relatively easy?
No, it's fairly easy. It's a cinnamon coffee cake. As long as you have good ingredient, good flour, good butter, and fresh eggs, quality cinnamon, you know, and then the good filling, because we'll put different cake, different filling. They come with cream cheese and bunch of different fruit filling like you would see on a coffee cake on a Danish. Strawberry, the most popular, strawberry, blueberry, praline, come up with all kind of different filling on the coffee cake.
So different fillings are okay? You know, sometimes traditionalists think that all that is just, you know, messing it up.
Yeah, it would be the traditional would be the cinnamon.
Traditional would be the cinnamon. Do you have a favorite?
Yes, I do have a favorite. I like the praline and brandy. I do a praline cream, and I finish it up with Southern Comfort liquor, mix it well together, and then fill it up inside the oblong cake, roll it, proof it, and bake it.
Oh, man. Now I'm really sad that I'm not there. I was doing okay, but now I'm really sad that I'm not there. Well, what are you going to do today? Do you have the day off to enjoy the festivities, or are you still turning them up?
Yeah, the bakeries are closed because we are so nearby the parade route. There is no traffic allowed for cars, only pedestrian, of course. And people are going to the route, on the route itself. I give the employee off, the happy, of course. I'm not even sure if anybody would like to come to work on Mardi Gras Day. I know.
So you might as well just give in, right?
That's it. But we need that day off because it's very stressful and very busy from King's Day, from January 6th, actually, right after Mardi Gras to now, after the Epiphany until now.
So the day of the Three Kings, or Epiphany, which is January 6th.
January 6th, right. The beginning of King Cake season.
All the way through now.
Right. And then we do King Cake. We have Super Bowl, so we do the color of the team of the Super Bowl. Last year was a lot of black and gold and fleur-de-lis shape. A King Cake, you know, in honor of our dear saints. Valentine was in the middle, too, so the King Cake and the shape of the heart, and they have red and pink sugar and stuff like that. You know.
So you need a break.
We need a little break. So now I'm going to enjoy it. I'm going to be on a parade route in a friend on St. Charles Avenue, which is one of the main avenues in New Orleans. He happened to have a home right there. And so the balcony is right overlooking the route, and that would be fantastic.
All right. Jean-Luc Albin is the owner and pastry chef of Maurice French Pastries just outside of New Orleans, and he was kind enough to take time out of his Mardi Gras celebrations to join us and tell us about the history of King Cake. Jean-Luc, thank you so much for joining us. Happy Mardi Gras.
Happy Mardi Gras to you. Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Happy Mardi Gras. Let's talk more tomorrow.
Breakthroughs are few and far between in science. That's why almost any scientific report making a bold claim is bound to attract attention. That's the case for a paper in the March issue of the Journal of Cosmology, not one of the more prestigious science journals. In it, a scientist at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center claims he found signs of life in a group of meteorites, and that raises the tantalizing possibility that life had once rained down on Earth from outer space. But, as NPR science correspondent Joe Palca reports, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof, and in this case, the proof is lacking.
This isn't the first time NASA scientist Richard Hoover has claimed to see signs of life in so-called carbonaceous meteorites, a kind of meteorite rich in the chemical building blocks of life. Why this particular paper and not others gained attention is one of those media mysteries. The main thrust of the paper is that a microscopic evaluation of these carbonaceous meteorites shows that they contain filaments that might have been made by a living organism, such as bacteria. But there are other explanations, too.
There are all sorts of chemical processes that lead to spheres and hollow balls and filaments.
George Cody is a geochemist at the Carnegie Institution for Science. In addition to chemical processes, Cody says it's hard to be certain that any signs of life you do see in meteorites found on Earth came from outer space.
So it's more likely than not that if you didn't take, you know, extraordinary precaution, then in fact they'd be quickly infected by both fungal microorganisms and bacteria as well.
So in other words, you pick this thing up off the ground and almost immediately, even from the bacteria and fungus on your hands, if you're not careful, you've contaminated the sample.
Absolutely. It would be probably completely unavoidable.
I couldn't reach Richard Hoover, so I can't speak directly to his motivations. But it's not hard to understand why a scientist would want to share what he thinks is a dramatic discovery with the world. Robert Hazen is a colleague of Cody's at the Carnegie Institution.
What you got to remember is scientists are discovery junkies. They always want to discover something new. That's why we're in the game. And if you discover something that seems like it might be extraordinary, there's this human nature. You tend to think, wow, I made this great discovery, as opposed to this can't be right.
But skepticism is crucial. 15 years ago, another group of scientists claimed they saw signs of life in a meteorite from Mars recovered in Antarctica. The media hoopla accompanying that paper was more justified, since the claim had been thoroughly vetted by other scientists, and NASA held a press conference trumpeting the results. A few years later, most scientists were convinced the finding was wrong, and this time NASA wants nothing to do with the new claims of life. Hazen says a finding that proves to be wrong isn't necessarily a bad thing.
We've learned so much from what was basically a bunch of Mars meteorites that don't have any compelling evidence for life, but they sure have some fascinating chemistry.
Hazen admits there's a small chance this new report is correct.
There have been some extraordinary claims in the past that turn out to be right. It takes years to confirm that they're right, but once in a while they aren't.
Hazen is sure of one thing. If the new claim is wrong,
it will be corrected. There's no question about it. Science will come up with the correct explanation for these filament-like structures, and we'll move on.
Eventually, closing in on the truth. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, while the world's attention is on Libya, the protests continue in Yemen, Bahrain, and Iraq. We'll get the latest analysis from Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera International. We'll talk to him in just a few minutes. But first, another in our series of conversations previewing this week's hearings by the House Homeland Security Committee, which is investigating, quote, the extent of radicalization in the American Muslim community and that community's response. Yesterday, we spoke with one of the two Muslim members of Congress, Representative Andre Carson, a Democrat who represents Indiana's 7th District. He expressed reservations about the scope and tone of the hearings. Now we turn to another Muslim man with a very different perspective. His testimony will be a centerpiece of the hearing. His name is Dr. M. Zudi Jasser. He is a physician in the Phoenix area, and he's also president and founder of a group called the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. Dr. Jasser joins us now from member station KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. Dr. Jasser, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me, Michelle. It's nice to be with you.
Now, Dr. Jasser, as you know, there has been a lot of controversy surrounding these hearings. Many people question the purpose of them. What is the benefit, do you think, of these hearings?
Well, I'll tell you, as a Muslim, we formed the organization because we realized that terrorism and radicalization is just a symptom, and that this is a Muslim problem that needs a Muslim solution. But, you know, in fact, if the solution is going to come from within, we have to engage and realize that the vast majority of Muslims are not radicalized. But we do have a problem. The amount of cells and radicalization that's been happening in the last 16 to 24 months has been exponentially increasing. And Secretary Napolitano testified to this committee that it's the highest it's ever been. So I think the best way to melt away any bigotry that may exist out there towards Muslims is for Americans to see that we are taking ownership, that we want to fix it. We recognize that violence is just a symptom, and we want to begin the hard work of reform.
What is your evidence that this philosophy has taken hold to enough of a segment of the population to warrant concern? What is your evidence about this phenomenon in the United States?
Well, what I would consider radical ideas, again, is not necessarily violence. I see a bigger problem of imams who have held up pictures of American soldiers in Iraq and said that these soldiers at their Friday prayers are raping and killing our children in Iraq, and saying that America is in a war against Islam. I've seen American Muslim organizations tell Muslims to only talk to the FBI if they have an attorney. I see groups like the Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America. It's a consortium of many imams of mosques around the country that gives Muslims fatwas or religious rulings on what to do. They've told fatwas to Muslims, don't do the Pledge of Allegiance. Don't work with Homeland Security because it's an infidel-type military that's not yours. Is that a majority? Absolutely not. Most Muslims don't believe that. But yet, these ideas are not just a psychiatric issue. It's a theopolitical movement that still is in the 15th and 16th century, and they talk about reform, but yet the ideology still hasn't gone through that intellectual reformation.
You know, I'm interested in two things you cite as an example of a problem, not saying the Pledge of Allegiance and seeking legal representation before talking to the FBI. Those are legal rights that Americans have. Other religious groups, Jehovah's Witnesses, for example, don't say the Pledge of Allegiance. People have a right to have legal representation and speaking before law enforcement. How is exercising one's legal rights as Americans indicative of a lack of loyalty?
It's not a lack of loyalty. It has to do with the amount of bandwidth that takes up in the dialogue going on in our communities and with our youth. It has to do with the fact that those groups you cited haven't had the number of homegrown incidents of terror that have come from Faisal Shahzad to Portland to Baltimore. All of these incidents on and on and on, they've been exponentially increasing, but yet we want to say that it's no different than Jared Lochner, who had psychiatric issues. So yes, our rights need to be preserved, but the predominant message needs to be, we recognize what the intoxicant is. The intoxicant is the supremacism of political Islam, and we want to take that away and reform to a spiritual, beautiful faith that has the same values of Judaism and Christianity and believes in the same legal system.
There are both Muslim Americans who take issue with these hearings and non-Muslims who take issue with the hearings. So let's take their objections each in turn. Earlier this week, we spoke with Representative Andre Carson of Indiana, one of two Muslim Americans currently serving in the U.S. Congress. He voiced his concern that these hearings might be counterproductive. I'll just play a short clip from the conversation just in case you were not able to hear it and get your reaction. Here it is.
I don't think it helps. I think it discourages Muslim Americans from participating with law enforcement and acting effectively as informants in many cases and really bridging the gap between law enforcement and our Muslim communities across this country.
What's your response to that?
I couldn't disagree more. I mean, there are many Muslim heroes. This is not the issue of those informants. It's not that Muslims wouldn't report that jihadist that's going to do that final violent step. I don't think that's where I have a concern. My concern is sort of the culture that when there is an informant, they sue the FBI like they're doing in California, and that sends a message that, no, don't be an informant. Don't work on these things. So Mr. Carson, in some ways, should also then be speaking out against CARE and their lawsuit in Southern California because on the one hand, he's saying that informants are good, but on the other hand, they're looking for opportunities, many of these groups that so far have dominated the platform, and it hasn't allowed us the hard work of reform to help resolve these issues.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Dr. Zudi Jasser. He is the founder and president of a group called the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. Later this week, he is expected to testify before the House Homeland Security Committee, which is investigating the question of whether American Muslims are being radicalized and whether that alleged radicalization poses a national security threat. Dr. Jasser supports these hearings, and he does plan to testify. As we said, also other groups, non-Muslim groups, have also expressed their concern about these hearings. There are two letters that were sent to Congressman Peter King, who is the chair of the Committee on Homeland Security, who's convening these hearings. One is from the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, a coalition of civil rights group. The other is from a group of faith leaders across Long Island, which Congressman King represents. They both say essentially the same thing, that they feel that these hearings as currently constituted will stoke anti-Muslim sentiment, increase suspicion and fear of the American Muslim community, that they will increase what they call racial profiling and generally contribute to a tearing of our civic fabric. That is their argument. What do you say to that?
Again, I couldn't disagree more. I think, again, that's denial and it is hyperbole in order to avoid the hard work. Where are the position papers of these organizations to talk about what is their solution? All we're doing and all Chairman King has done is to bring forth Muslims now in the beginning to say, how do we solve this? And what is the coordinated strategy we need to have once we figure out what the problem is and how to solve it? And I think that a lot of the hyperbole is stoking the flames more. So to say this is all about being Muslim and Islam and all this, rather than say, well, hold on a second. Islam is the solution. Spiritual, compassionate faith is the solution. And all I think the hearings are doing is trying to build a platform for Muslim groups and individuals that want to find solutions and build a public-private strategy to figure out how to take it to that next level. As Prime Minister Cameron said in England, he said, we need a muscular liberalism to give these youth an identity within British society, American society, so that they don't get radicalized. Nidal Hassan, you asked me about evidence before. Nidal Hassan didn't become radical overnight. He didn't have a psychotic issue. He, over years, was being radicalized into an ideology that ultimately led to Imam Awlaki. Imam Awlaki went from a Denver mosque to a San Diego mosque to a Northern Virginia mosque, and the Northern Virginia mosque said, oh, we didn't see anything, when ultimately you could actually see his ideas as being sort of precursors towards that end step, which is violence, and violence is just that final step.
Well, then what about those who point to Jared Loughner, who is the accused assailant in the Tucson shooting? He was not a Muslim, didn't apparently belong to any religious group, but engaged in what many people consider to be an act of terrorism, certainly a vicious act of violence. People look at incidents like that and they say, why isn't that kind of thing the subject of congressional hearings?
If people feel it should be, it should be. Separate hearings on are we treating psychiatric patients well? Are they marginalized, et cetera? I mean, that's a whole other topic. You can't combine everything into one, you know, hearing for a few hours and figure out that we can get some solutions. And, you know, our country was founded on a comfortable discussion of diversity within religion. Our documents were based on Christian diversity, where we realized that an anti-theocratic movement developed a constitution and an establishment clause with an open discussion of religion. So why can't we have that same discussion to say, you know what, one of the violent extremisms in America is, and the most significant one that led to the whole formation of our Department of Homeland Security, was related to Islamist radicalism from Al-Qaeda and its continued threat. So if we're going to address that threat, we need to focus on the root cause, which I believe is a theopolitical movement that has hijacked a good number of Muslims. A minority, but it's a good number that we need to treat, and it's increasing exponentially.
And finally, I asked this question of Representative Carson, and so I wanted to ask you the same question. What is a constructive way forward from here?
I think a constructive way forward is to say, okay, do we recognize there's a problem? Is it increasing? And how do we then create a coordinated strategy to start to, as Prime Minister Cameron said, drain the pool of the fuel of that the violent extremists swim in? And how do we begin to truly assimilate Muslims into an ideology that is American, that is British, that is Western, so that they aren't pulled into this jihadi cool, into this cyber jihad that is so much a threat and continues to be a threat?
How do these hearings advance that goal, given that they have, at least for some people, cause them to feel stigmatized and demeaned by their own government? How does it advance that cause of encouraging people to feel more bonded and loyal to this country? Do you see my question?
Yeah, I completely understand. And I hope these things, what you just asked, remains at the forefront of our conversation, is that we realize there's a problem, but we realize that the most important part of that's the solution is from the Muslim community. So yes, we can't marginalize Muslims, but on the other hand, we also can't avoid the tough discussions of theology that lends to radicalization if that is part of the problem. So I hope we have a climate on Capitol Hill that we can talk about these things and figure out how to counter it and let Muslims have new platforms to take responsibility. I think that would be the best treatment for any fear out there of Muslims or Islam.
Dr. M. Zudi Jasser is a physician. He practices in the Phoenix area. He's also founder and president of a group called the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. And he joined us from member station KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. Dr. Jasser, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.